Welcome back to The Better Picture, where we get close, stay focused, and keep shooting. Thanks to Red River Radio and to all of our listeners, local and all over the world. This is a call-in show. We invite you to call in for questions or comments about photography at 800-552-8502. We generally have a smartphone minute, but tonight we're going to substitute that for hot air balloon tips, since we have hot air balloons taking off a couple hundred yards from where we're sitting in the studio today. Our guest tonight is Dr. Glenn Mills, whose quite extensive and impressive postings can be seen on Flickr at gmills31, or you can go and see a small sampling at thebetterpicture.org. If you're not driving, then I invite you to go to those pages while you are listening to the show and get a sense of what we're doing. If you have questions about the pictures, we have Dr. Mills in the studio with us to answer those questions. So first, let's welcome Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me tonight.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I'm set the stage. You are not a professional photographer, though your pictures are worth buying. You're a medical doctor, a professor, the interim chair of medicine at LSU Shreveport School of Medicine, the director of Feistweiler Cancer Center. You're researching genomic sequencing of cancers, and it goes on and on. But tonight, we're going to look to a passion other than saving lives, that of photography. So let's set the stage. Where did you get started in photography?
Well, I guess I got started originally my senior year in high school. I was the photographer for the sports and for the annual, took some pictures. And then when later I got into college and in medical school, I really got my first first 35 millimeter camera, Pentax Spotmatic F.
Oh,
and that's what I
camera.
Learned on.
Yeah. Great,
right.
Great old camera.
Great camera.
And now, obviously, that's out of high school. What were you doing with it? What was the attraction? What were you shooting?
Well, I liked even then to take some pictures of landscapes, take pictures when we went on vacation. I got married in medical school, and my wife and I would go up into the Smokies and take some pictures on. And I had a good friend who would develop the old contact sheets, black and white.
Right.
Where you could, and so I got sort of interested in, never did get into developing as such, but that sort of fueled my interest. And
Did you ever get into the darkroom to print?
I did with him, but I never really did much on my own.
Okay. One of the things about film, some people like the smell of the chemicals, and that's part of the attraction. You like the outdoors.
I like the outdoors and taking the pictures more than the developing, I think.
Now, were you doing this during medical school?
Yes, during medical school, when summers you had some time off, and around the holidays you could go do things.
Did you find it a diversion from the rigors of medical
school?
Yeah,
you got to have something to keep your focus when you're in school. You're studying really hard, but you need to take some time off for yourself and have something outside, whether it's playing the piano or reading or taking pictures. There's got to be something outside of medicine to that you can go lose yourself in.
Well, if you're looking something to take your focus, I guess a camera would be a great thing to do.
Yes, it is.
And obviously that was in film days.
Right.
Do you have a particular film you like?
I shot a lot of black and white on trichrome.
Yeah, the Tri-X. Yeah.
Kodachrome slides. I did a lot of slides. Particularly later on, after I left medical school, I was in the Army, and we went to Hawaii for 3 years, where I did my initial training after medical school. And oh, what a place to take pictures that was.
Oh, I bet. You still have those Kodachrome slides hanging around?
Boxes of them in my office, which I keep saying I'm going to digitize one of these days.
Right.
And it just doesn't seem to happen.
Well, if you're going to get in the line for those of us who have boxes of slides to digitize, it's a long line.
It is.
It is a long line. Well, one of the things that has amazed me, Kodachrome, as you said, was the standard.
Right.
And you had to be right. You couldn't deviate. The equivalent megapixels of a Kodachrome slide is about 22 megapixels.
Right.
So now you can routinely buy cameras with twice the resolution power of what we had back then.
Exactly, and you can make twice as many mistakes at least as well.
And the, and one of the advantages of the digital is you can save some of those mistakes.
Yes.
Now, I mean, I've looked at your work, and you obviously get it right in the camera and then use post-production for enhancements and polishment.
You know, I think that if you started off doing film cameras, that you learned more technique than you do nowadays sometimes people with their digital cameras. They don't learn about the f-stop and, you know, about aperture and ISO and depth of field or focal distances. Whereas when you were back in the film days and you had to get it right because you're sending it off to somebody to develop or it's a wasted shot and wasted money,
right,
you took a lot more time to learn those things.
Yeah, and you didn't get the immediate feedback.
You didn't. Now you take your picture, you can look at that monitor on your camera, and you know right away whether you have the shot or not.
Right. And for those who will actually use a histogram, are you a histogram user?
Oh, yes. I use the histogram all the time.
Okay. And for the novices, the histogram is one of the tools that we use on digital cameras that tells you basically how much light you have in each of the different zones and ranges.
Right.
And I'm not good at using it. I'll look at it and go, I know that's bad. I don't know how to fix it.
Well, I do, as we'll talk about hopefully later on, a lot of HDR work where you take multiple images at under and overexposed. And basically what I use it for is I want to make sure that histogram, at least one of them, the right side doesn't have any light, and one of them, the left side doesn't have any light. Then I know I've got the whole range of light captured.
Right.
So that's really where I use it mainly, is in that HDR.
Well, that's great. Our guest tonight is Dr. Glenn Mills. If you're just tuning in, you can reach us at 800-552-8502 for questions on photography, comments on photography. Well, you were shooting in Hawaii. I've never been, but I understand it would be fabulous lighting and plenty of topics.
Yes, beautiful parks. I mean, there were just gorgeous waterfalls, more waterfalls than you could imagine.
Did you ever take a pause from photography? Did you kind of put it down and have to go to work?
Yeah, I think after we left Hawaii and came back to San Antonio, it got more involved in my training. That's when I specialized in cancer from internal medicine. And I got involved in medical research, clinical trials, drug development, bone marrow transplant. And it really started consuming my time and my research. And I didn't have as much time for photography for many years. So other than maybe taking a few pictures on the family vacation with the kids, that was about it for 20 years.
More documentary than
right. Than taking those artistic slides that, again, are somewhere in boxes somewhere.
Well, that is always a problem with the storage and the dissemination. Did you do the scrapbooks where you'd have?
Oh, yes, with each kid. One of the things I found I could use my Kodachromes, particularly from Hawaii, I put them in my lectures. So I made it a habit of whenever, and I give a lot of lectures to students, residents, groups outside the hospital. You know how when you give a talk that you come to inflection points where you're sort of changing emphasis a little? I put in one of my pictures, a slide.
Or transition point.
And it's my transition points or my photography. And I can talk just a second about that photograph and then move on to the lecture. It sort of tells me that I'm inflecting here, you know, and transitioning to something.
Well, that's one of the uses of photography, that it is a turning point. It's something that takes it back. And I can imagine that the lectures you were giving probably need a break occasionally to let the students.
Yeah, you have to catch your breath.
You have to catch your breath. Well, what brought you back to shooting?
Well, I guess as the kids had gotten older, I would go to a lot of medical meetings, research meetings to learn what's current or present our data. And we started, my wife and I, taking a few days, because we would go to some very nice places and say, boy, we should enjoy ourselves. We went on a quest to start seeing all the national parks, we decided. And so as we started doing that, I got more interested again in photography and taking pictures in the national parks. So I developed my interest in photography again, you know, in these beautiful national parks, which are a treasure for our nation.
Well, from your Flickr pages and from the things that you've shared, it's obvious you have that love of the outdoors. When you started back with this, was that still film or those in boxes somewhere in your office?
It really was starting in the early digital ages. There are a few film shots, but it was mainly digital at this time.
And when you shifted to digital, was that a big transition for you?
Well, it was a transition. The cameras are the same. I started with the original Canon Digital Rebel, you know, the very first one. And now it was a... Taking the picture was like taking it with film. You know, you had to get everything right. But now it was developing your pictures yourself. Now you didn't depend on sending them off to some company to send you the slides back or, you know, taking them to the Walgreens and having them print out for you. Now you did your own. And so you had to start developing skills a little bit different then. And I guess I learned to appreciate my photography better when I could see the obvious mistakes in the dark room, sitting in front of your computer monitor now is the dark room.
Right.
And say, oh, I should have done this a little different here, you know? I should have done this a little different. And it really broadened my understanding of photography.
Well, as you shifted in the digital world from that rudimentary, the basic one, the Rebel, as cameras got more either forgiving or more competent, depending on your view on it, did you find it relax your standards, or have you maintained that raised on film?
I think I maintained to some extent that raised on film. I like to try to get the exposures right when I'm on the scene, when I'm out there looking at nature and on a trail or in the park. I think if you get it right, then there's some things you can fix in the digital darkroom, but there are others you can't fix.
Right.
You know, it's a difference between a spectacular image and a good image that's nice and technically correct, but you concentrate more on getting the light right, being at the scene at the right time of the day.
And did you find your treatment of light different with film and with the digital formats that you have now?
I think I understood light more nowadays than I did in the older days. I think I learned as I progressed in my photography to appreciate it more.
When you were shooting in the field before, you were shooting some black and white or some slides.
Right.
And, of course, whatever film you have in your camera is what you have to use. I mean, you don't get to switch.
That is true.
You know, and you've done some amazing... I love one of your firework pictures in black and white, which is not a concept most people would think about. I mean, fireworks, we have all the ooh and ah of the different colors.
Right.
If you had Kodachrome and wanted to do that in your camera, you couldn't, whereas with the digital now...
Right. With the digital, it is so simple. As we'll talk, as many of the listeners may know, you have a choice of shooting in what's called RAW, along with JPEG. JPEG means the image is developed in the camera to some extent, but the raw is the light you see. And if you record that, a raw image, when you take it back to your digital darkroom and use whatever software you want to use, you can do a black and white or you can do a color. It doesn't matter because you've got the raw light just like you saw it, and now you can develop it however you wish.
Ansel Adams is quoted as having said, the negative is the score and the print is the performance. And now the digital darkroom, echoing what you said, you have so many more instruments.
You do. It's amazing. The new iPads, as we were talking earlier, are phenomenal in what they can do with development of your pictures.
Yes.
Where you can select parts of your image to develop.
Well, as you got interested and came back into the fold and started shooting, did you go back and take any training? Did you take any courses?
Well, as I got interested in Flickr about 10 years ago, one of the great things about Flickr, it's a photo sharing site on the web, and people come and look at your pictures and they comment on them, give you awards, and you can get constructive comments. But I met some guys that really had spectacular landscape images and became friends with them on Flickr, and we were sharing and talking about our images. And the three of them went together that had been my Flickr friends and formed a workshop group called Mountain High Workshops and said, hey, we're going to start offering workshops. And I said, oh, great, I'll sign up. I'd never done anything like this. So I signed up, and that was my first experience. And I was hooked. It was one of the best vacations, if you will, I'd ever spent. 5 days out in the field with a group of people whose only interest was in taking pictures, taking the best pictures, and teaching while you were in the field. Both in the field and back at the hotel in the dark digital dark room, showing you how to develop your images.
Now, a lot of people talk about going and taking those courses and just don't pull the trigger. I mean, you were going with people that apparently you never met but were friends over Flickr.
Right.
Take us through a day. I mean, that you say it's a vacation, but some of your pictures are sunrises and some are sunsets. And I mean, that's a long day.
Your day starts probably about an hour and a half to 2 hours before sunrise. When you get up, grab you something to eat real quick, and hit the field to go to your first place to shoot. You like to be in place at least 30 to 45 minutes before sunrise. So that's the golden hour in the morning. And then you have the golden hour right at before sunset at the end of the day. You want to be in position and have your shoot planned. So they would take us to places they'd already scouted and knew the sun was going to be at the right angle. It was going to be a perfect shot of some arch or some hill or mountain or the river. And you would get in position waiting for the sun to come up. And then you shoot just wildly for the next 30 minutes to try to capture all the images you can in that beautiful light. And then we would shoot around in the day, but we would go back to the hotel for lunch, and then when the light is so bright and harsh, it's usually not good to shoot pictures, we would stay in the hotel and go to the digital darkroom classes where people would pull out their laptops and the instructors would come around and give you hints we would carry projectors so we could look at images that the students had made. We'd head back out into the field then and shoot the last 2 hours of the day and frequently stay shooting at night and do painting. You know, you can paint with light at night using your tripod and long exposures, or do star images at night. So you'd get back to the hotel at 9 or 10 exhausted to get up at 4 o'clock the next morning. But it was just wonderful experience. And to this day, I still like to do workshops.
And when you go with these pros, the people that have scouted and know, are they working with you on shaping your vision or on shaping your exposure?
Both. I mean, most of the workshops I've been on, it's about an instructor ratio of 1 to 3 or 1 to 4. And they'll divide it up. There'll be 4 or 5 instructors, 20 students. And they're sort of, you know, here's a group of people just starting, here's some intermediates, here's some people that are more advanced. And they would divide the students up in those lines. So you could get no matter the level of your experience in photography, you're going to get a lot of training at this workshop.
And how many workshops have you done now?
I've done about 7 or 8.
And how many with this same group?
Well, the group stayed in existence for about 5, I guess. The first 5 I did was with them. And then they sort of went their own way, doing different things, not doing workshops. And then I've had some other workshops I've done.
And so when you go back the 4th time with the same basic group, is it refresher, or are they saying, Glenn's more expert, let's kick him up a notch?
They'd kick you up a notch, you know. And a lot of them were – and in this group I had – 2 of the guys, like one was a retired chemical engineer, one was a radiologist from Idaho, but one was a professional photographer. That's what he decided. He was spending all his life taking landscape pictures. So it was a varied group. But yeah, they would increase. It was just mainly, I found in the later workshops, it forced me to get out there and actually do it. You know, sometimes you get a little lazy when you're on your vacation. You don't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get out there and take pictures. But this really, I found that I could get better, you know, just being there and doing it with them.
I take it this was a solo exercise, not with your wife and family.
No, they weren't photography. They're not into photography right. Like I am.
So this is a total immersion into that particular
right.
Project.
Totally immersed in photography for the length of your workshop.
We are talking with Dr. Glenn Mills. You can call in your questions at 800-552-8502. If you've looked at any of his work, then you'll know it's not just excellent composition. It's not just proper exposure, but there's a fair amount of artistic added value in the dark room, in the digital dark room. Not having worked in a dark room, you may not appreciate, to really do printing and stuff was a several hour exercise till your eyes got adjusted. And if you went out to get a beer, you were ruined and had to start over.
Exactly. It was an arduous process.
In the post-production work that you do, let's chat for a second about that. Do you take the picture in the field and say, I can do this to it? Or is it something you get back and look on the screen and go, you know what, this really needs to be tweaked?
It's a combination of both. You know, I was at the Sunflower Festival we had here recently, and I knew the image I wanted was sunflowers against the blue sky. So I was concentrating on shooting up so that I could capture the sunflower with a nice blue sky behind it. So I knew ahead of time what I wanted. You know, I'd sort of, because I've shot there before. So I was trying to capture those, and then I did some other images with the sun behind the sunflower, you know, and the rays of light. And then you go through your images and see which best match your vision of what you wanted to capture.
Right. Now, you'd mentioned the high dynamic range.
Right.
And that's something you have to decide ahead of time you're going to do.
Correct.
I mean, you don't shoot everything envisioned towards that, do you?
No, I don't. I don't usually, unless I'm – when I'm out shooting in the round the – early and late in the day when the light is so changed, I will shoot everything. I'll shoot three images of everything, over and under exposed and a correctly exposed image. That's just my routine setting. Now, I may never use that as an HDR. I may just go with the correctly exposed image, but I've got it there if I want to do it.
So your camera is, you have your camera set. When you take the picture, it takes three images.
Automatically does three images, right? I've got it set so that it shoots the three images if I need them.
And how much over and under do you shoot?
I usually do a -2 and a +2. Now, if I know that I'm going to need HDR because of the wide range of light, I might shoot 9 images, +1, +2, +3, +4. -1, -2, -3, -4. But then I'm sort of planning to do that. That's not my routine setting.
So when you get to back to your desk and you've got your digital dark room opened, mm-hmm. which I always think is funny because it's no longer a dark room.
Right.
It's when you get that done, I don't understand, and I'm not sure many of our viewers would, how you combine those. Is that just software?
It's software. You can do it in Photoshop. I use a different Photomatics Pro is the program I use. You can use Nick Software has one. There's several softwares out there that'll grab your three images and merge it for you. And you manipulate it a little with a few settings, which aren't very hard to learn, and you turn out an image that has the correct range of light. You mentioned the histogram earlier. When you're sitting there at your computer and you look at your image and you look at the histogram, if you're losing something on either the right or the left, you don't have all the light. Part of your picture is either going to be under or overexposed. So if you've got all three images, hopefully you've got that extra light. You won't lose it.
But when it merges it together and you have three pictures of the house with a dark door and the bright light coming through the window,
mm-hmm.
it knows pick up the lighter door and bring down the light.
It does, and I guess that's so. I don't understand how it works,
right.
But it works.
Right.
You know, it's exactly what you described. It's like being inside a room where it's very bright outside, and it's dark. It's a little darker in your room. And if you take a standard picture, it'll either be okay in the room, but looking out the window, it'll be too bright to see anything, or it'll be okay looking out in the bright light. But the inside of the room will be too dark, and you can't see anything. And HDR makes everything right.
Well, that was one of the things that amazed me about the new digital cameras. I was playing with just a very rudimentary program, and as I moved one of the sliders over, a part of the picture that was, to me, looked black, suddenly out came handles. And I mean, the camera saw things I didn't.
Yes. If you shoot in RAW, even with one image, you can go up about almost to 1.5 up and down, at least one, plus one and right. minus one, just with the RAW image. So if you have a little underexposure or a little overexposure, you can correct it as you develop that RAW image.
Did you learn or get interested in the high dynamic range work at one of the workshops?
At the workshop I learned. Okay. The first workshop I went to, they taught this technique, and I sort of adopted it, and that's really become almost my standard. Nowadays, if I'm on a tripod and shooting, I do three images of everything.
And do you do most of your work off a tripod?
Oh, yes. When I'm shooting outside, yes, everything. If I'm doing street scenes or walking around, I might use a monopod. I have a monopod I like to take. Vibration or movement is the enemy of the photographer. It takes away your sharpness. So anything you can do to stabilize yourself, leaning up against a building, leaning up against a tree, you know, helping to prop your hands and the camera against the tree, that'll decrease the shake. Even with these cameras that have the reduction built in, the vibration resistance, I find really helps my images be sharper. If you vibrate at all, move at all, you lose that sharpness.
Right, the crisp jump off the page type stuff.
Yes.
And that's one of the things you can't pull back.
You can't get that back.
You can't get that back. When you are shooting with these instructors, and it intrigues me that a person with your eye and your composition would go to work with the pros like that. Do you feel like they influenced your style or just released your style?
Both. I think they help your creative eye, but they teach you the kind of things that I didn't know, like the interest points of your photograph. If you look at a photograph and put a tic-tac-toe board on top of it, you know, with the crossed lines, the places where you want your emphasis is where the lines cross. That's the rule of thirds. They talk about leading lines in your photograph, like having some kind of line come from the bottom to go towards one of the top corners, like a river or stream or a fence line. They talk about having interest in the foreground that brings you into the picture that displays your beautiful background. So getting the foreground elements right so that can enhance actually your background, which will be the spectacular vista of the park. But putting that old stump or that rock or something in the foreground gives interest.
Leads you into
the image. So they talk to you about, and that helps you to develop your eye. And it changed how I looked at the scenes. Now I realized, oh, I don't want a picture with a barren foreground. That doesn't have any interest. I need to look for something that I can put in the foreground that'll give interest to my image.
Okay. At this point, we're going to shift over and take our hot balloon tips for just a second. As those of you locally know, that we have the national hot air balloon races going on this week, culminating at the end of the week. And they do magnificent things. They do a balloon glow at dusk where they light up the balloons and they're all illuminated. But it poses some challenges that we're here to give you a few tips on. As always, and as Dr. Mills had said, you have to scout your position ahead of time. Balloons don't move real fast, but they do move. And once they start, when you realize that you have a Walmart behind or a power line right in front of it, it's too late to get back. So as in most photographic exercises, you have to get to where the scene's going to be before the action starts and really put a critical eye as to how wide those balloons are going to open. I mean, they're stretched out on the ground long and skinny, but they get pretty fat. And if you've got a telephoto lens on it, you've limited what you can do. There are also some counterintuitive things. We normally say do not shoot directly into the sun. You want to be having the sun behind you. But if you're doing the balloon glow, the light that you're going to have inside the balloon is going to be much richer if you put the sun behind it instead of reflecting off of the balloon surface itself. So that's one of those counterintuitive tips, is get there and say, let's look towards Texas here. Let's look to the west and see where it's going to be. And then get your background situated and be ready with it. Now, have you shot balloons?
Once or twice I've shot some balloons. You know, and it is hard. You know, you got to, that's some good hints, I think. I like too to, if you can get that balloon, if you shoot at a very small aperture, high f-stop, and get the sun to just peek at the edge of your balloon,
right,
you get the starburst effect, and that can create a spectacular image to get those rays of the sun in your image.
One of the other tips that I would suggest trying is use an aperture preferred setting instead of a shutter preferred, and that lets you select how much you're going to have in focus. But when those guys hit the gas and that bright flame flares up, it changes the exposure pretty drastically, pretty quickly.
Yes.
And when they cut it off, it's gone. Well, your camera can react to that, whereas you may not. So if you go to shutter and trust your camera to adjust for the lights, now, obviously, as we were speaking earlier, you got the advantage of immediate feedback. And if they're all too dark, then you can change the composition some, change the exposure some. One of the other things to look at is, remember, the balloon is not just one big bulb. There are many moving parts to it. There's the basket. There's the internal lights. When they start filling them up, there are shots into the middle of it. So getting explored, I have found, as in most sports, if you talk to the people that are involved, they love to talk about their sport. And you can get in and talk to some of the pilots, and they will tell you, watch what happens when I do this. So you get to learn a little bit more about it. I've always marveled at people that could shoot a sport they never played, because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, with every photograph is a projection into the future. And, you know, I've often said, if you see the picture you want, you missed it. You've got to anticipate it being there. Well, unless you have some input from the people to say what's going to happen with it. Another good tip, because, you know, you're not going to be the only camera there. Everybody's jockeying for a position, and chances are somebody else is scattered at yours. Don't hog the position. Take your shot and give it to somebody else. But as the balloons start to rise, 6 feet up, you're shooting over everybody's head, so you can get the crowd out of it.
Right.
Now, you may want the crowd in it for composition purposes, but you got to know what you're shooting before it starts, because after a while, the only arch you've got is directly straight up at the basket silhouetted by the balloon.
That could be interesting too, looking straight up.
I'm going. I've never shot one. I've talked to people. I've read. Another great idea before you hit the scenes is put in hot air balloon photography into Google. And look at some of what the pros have done. It's not really a workshop, but it's an idea to say, oh, some inflated, some deflated, some fully inflated. It's a good composition. But if you don't have an idea of what's going to happen, you're not going to do it.
There's actually an app called Stuck on Earth. It's by a friend of mine on Flickr called Stuck in Customs. He's got a wonderful website, but this is a free app, and it's a world map, and you can zoom into it. And as you zoom in, Flickr photographs that have been geomapped start popping up. So if you're going to go visit Arches National Park, you can, on this app, go there on the map, expand it, and you'll see pictures taken at Arches. And you can see what kind of pictures you can make at that spot. So anytime you go and you're going out to the parks, look at what other people have done. Search Arches, search use apps like Stuck on Earth, or a lot of my professional friends, they look at the photographs. They go to a new site to shoot, they'll go in the convenience store or the drugstore or something, and they'll look at the postcards and say, oh, this is the kind of things we need to look for, this site, you know. And but I think I could do it better than that, you know, with this light.
We all do. Yeah, we all think we can do it better. Well, that's, of course, with hot air balloons, we're not stuck on Earth. We're right. getting up in the air. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take my webpage, thebetterpicture.org, and I'm going to open that up for everybody in Shreveport that's taking a picture. Send me your favorite balloon picture, and I'm going to do a balloon page.
That'd be great.
There's no prize. There's no money, but there's publication. And if you're like most of us who are not supporting ourselves on that, putting out our vision and having somebody else look at it is a fun thing. So all you have to do is pick your one favorite balloon shot that you've taken and send it to Ross at thebetterpicture.org. Give me a while to create it. I'm my own webmaster, so that's not the fastest thing happening. And then we're going to sling your pictures up. I like to have kind of camera your settings because most of the camera geeks like to know what you shot and what you did, and it's very helpful in training. So that's Ross at thebetterpicture.org, and we will have Shreveport's own private collection of our finest work.
So sounds like fun.
Yeah, that would be the challenge. Phone number is 800-552-8502. If you have a question for photography in general or for Dr. Mills, then give us a call. Let's talk for a second about the actual, what I call the zone of photography. When you're going out, and your work obviously shows it's a very studied and intense thing, does the rest of the world just disappear?
It does to me. When I'm out there in the parks, which is where I really love to go, I just don't think about anything except where I am and the shot and the beauty of the scene. You know, and you can forget everything else with just lose yourself out there.
Now, when you're doing street photography, do you get into a different zone looking at people?
I'm not as much into street photography. I do a little bit.
Yeah.
But I just don't seem to have the same eye for that as I do for other things. It's harder with street photography because you're trying to be not noticed. It's a little bit different. And my friends that do it well tend to use smaller cameras that are quiet so that it's sort of sneaky, I guess, if you will, when they're out on the streets photographing.
When you're standing on a point with a tripod and a camera mounted waiting for the cloud to get just right, it's not much sneaky, is it?
Not much sneaky about doing that, no.
Not much sneaky. We got a call? All right.
Yeah, we do indeed. So so this is Patrick from Shreveport. Patrick, go ahead.
Oh, hey. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on, Dr. Mills. Glad to be here.
Oh, welcome.
I just had a question for you. So I'm an amateur photographer at best, and I'm thinking about lens selection when I'm going out to take pictures, like going to the balloon festival or, you know, walking the street. I always struggle between should I have a prime lens or a zoom lens, and if I do have a zoom, what range I should take. Do you have kind of a go-to lens that you choose? Do you prefer prime or zoom? What are your thoughts?
Well, depending on the camera that you're using, whether it's an APS-C size sensor or the bigger full frame, on the full frame, I do a 24-72. That's your go-to lens for walking around. The 24 gives you some wide angle. The 72 gives you a little bit of zoom. Now, in your APS-Cs, you might have something that's like a 16 or 18 to at least 54 or 70. And when you do the math to correct for your camera, that'll be about like a 24 to 105. Most of the APS-C cameras have a crop factor of 1.5. So I would use something in that mid-range that's got you a little bit of wide angle and a little bit of zoom in one lens, because you never know what you're going to. If I were going to the balloon, when I go to the balloon festival, I'm going to take a 24-72. That's going to be my main lens that I use. If you were going to want the sharpest possible image that you can get, use a prime. They're much sharper than the zooms. But the zooms are your standby that are good all-around lenses. Not quite as sharp as the prime, but it gives you more range and more latitude.
Patrick, another thing that you can think about doing, and I've done this in the past, I look at my lens selection and decide, you know, today I'm feeling secretive and invasive, and I'll put just a long prime on. Mm-hmm. Or I may think, I'm looking at the world in general, and I'm basically making a decision to limit my lens choice to one particular angle of view. And I find when I walk the streets or when I'm going out at that point in time, I look in that angle. I mean, I'm looking for, you know, if I have the wide angle lens on the camera, I'm not looking for the little detail. I'm looking for how does the overall composition. So that's one of the ways you can try that. But I think Dr. Mills is correct. When you go into something like the Balloon Festival and you have no clue what's going to happen, you really need some wide angle. Because I'm telling you, those balloons do get wide, and you put three of them next to each other. If you can't spread it out, then you're going to lose what could be a fabulous composition.
Right.
And the zooms today are approaching the primes. They're not quite there. I mean, many years ago, when the two graybeards at the microphone were starting, zooms were a compromise, and the compromise was much more sharpness.
Yeah.
Than changing. One of the things that's also important to remember with a digital camera is, if you're out in a dusty field in some of the areas, you don't want to be changing lenses a lot. If you change lens on a film camera and got a dust spot, the next time you take a picture and advance the film, the dust goes with it. If you change the lens on a digital and get a dust spot, it's in every picture you take until you have the guts to clean the sensor or till you send it off to have somebody done. So take it. I mean, the ideal thing is to take two different camera bodies with two different lengths, but that's getting a little...
Yeah, just change those lenses as fast as you can,
right,
where the wind doesn't blow in it, right, when you change. That's
turn your wind to the back, and it's probably better to keep the body of the camera turned down. When you're changing the lenses. You can always clean the back of a lens much easier than you can clean the sensor.
Right.
But I think that's a 24 to 100 range is a really good working area.
Right.
Anything else, Patrick?
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Appreciate the call.
It. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And I might add, too, for Patrick and our other listeners, there are photography groups in town you can join where you can meet like people and go out on shoots together. There's a group called the Red River Photographers that is on Meetup, an app you can get for your phone. And they're actually coming out to the Balloon Festival. One of the meetups is going to be out there with the Red River Photographers, I think Friday evening for the Balloon Globe.
For the Balloon Globe.
Yeah, it's about 12, 15 people will show up and, you know, sort of meet as a group. And they'll be very experienced people and people just starting out. And you just shoot some pictures together.
And that's probably one of the best ways to learn. If you're standing next to somebody and their picture is really crisp and yours is not, ask them.
Right,
exactly. I have yet to run into a photographer that doesn't want to talk about their pictures.
Oh, they love it. In fact, that picture you mentioned of mine, the black and white, that was at a meetup with Red River Photographers down on the boardwalk when they had the fireworks on the barge out on 4th of July. That's where I took that picture.
But it was shot digitally, and you looked at it and said, what would that be like in black and white?
I just said, what will it look like in black and white? I just happened to think about it, and I changed the raw image to a black and white, and it really was quite striking.
Well, you also did some fabulous black and white landscapes out west, cloud structures. They look almost infrared, the way the darkness of the cloud got in. So... if you have questions, call us at 800-552-8502. You know, we are more than happy to sit and talk about cameras and photography, but we would love to answer any questions that you may have. The idea of getting together with other people is a great one. When you go out shooting, group or not, does time fly?
Oh, yes. It really flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
No matter what we do.
Yeah. And do you go in search of specific things?
Yes. I keep my eye open and I look for scenes. Sometimes I'm going for something specific, like if I'm going to a park, I know there's going to be certain scenes I'm going to want to shoot because I've done my research ahead of time. And I'll spend the day, and you know, when my wife and I drive around the park, I'll plan where I'm going to shoot sunset, and I'm planning where I'm going to come back to shoot my sunrise, during the day, because I'll know when the light, I'll say, oh, the sun's going to come up here, this is going to be great, this is where I want to do my sunrise, because of all the interesting elements I can capture.
Now, you use a program called Photographer's Ephemeris.
Correct.
Which will really tell you the angle of the sun and where it's going to rise on the horizon anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. It's E-P-H-E-R, Ephemeris. It you can pull it out and say it'll GPS you right where you are, and you can say, show me where the sun's going to come up on this landscape. Show me where it's going to set. Show me the moon. What time? It'll give you all that information. So you can do that ahead of time as well when you're sitting at home on the computer. You can, there's a computer version. You can call that up and figure out where you want to be when you go to the park or go to shoot your pictures.
And that's like the balloon thing or any other photo shoot you're after. That's just the research and preparation.
Right.
I was fortunate enough to be out near Moab, near the arches, and had some friends crazy enough to get me up in the morning, and we were out there and hiked in the dark and got up ready for the sunrise. And I was not on the wrong side of the arch, but I was not on the point that I should have been to catch that sun just peeking up and breaking into the arch. Had I had a better preparation, more experience, or a person with me that had been there, I would have known 10 yards down is a different composition.
Exactly.
You know, that's the preparation that we have. When you are out, you mentioned that you just see things and you're planning some, but then other ones spot you. Neil Johnson, one of our local great photographers and actually the first guest on The Better Picture, always refers to the muse. He said when the muse jumps on his back, he just has to stop. And is your family tolerant of you saying we got to stop the car?
Oh, yeah, we have to stop the car frequently. We'll see an image, and I'll turn around and go back. So, oh, I got to have this, so I'll turn around and go back to where we just drove past.
Right.
It's amazing the number of beautiful scenes you can shoot just from your car on the side of the road in our country. And even if you're not into hiking or you can't, you can capture beautiful images just off the road. You know?
And there are plenty of images out there. If you're shooting at a 250th of a second, which is a pretty standard shutter speed, there are 900,000 possible pictures every hour.
So you've
got plenty of options that are out there.
I was driving between two hospitals just the other day, and I ran across two interesting pictures. One was an old building with a little graffiti on it that I said, oh, boy, this will be great as the sun hits it in the morning. And another was a tractor with some sunflowers. I said, oh, I'm going to have to come back here in the morning, too, and shoot that. So that's where I'm going to, this weekend, I'm going to go by there, those sites in the morning, and shoot those two sites.
So we got another caller?
We do. This is Charles from Shreveport. Charles, go ahead.
Good afternoon or good evening.
Good evening.
I used to shoot strictly film with an old Minolta SRT 200, and I've just recently gotten a digital camera and really kind of lost in a lot of this gizmos and stuff on this camera. You're talking about RAW. I know you take most pictures and they save them in a JPEG. How do you go and you set your camera to shoot RAW, and then if you want to do something different with it, how do you change that format?
What type of camera do you have?
It's a Canon 80DS.
Oh, great camera. I had the old 40D that I did a lot of my work with, which was several generations, you know, prior to the 80. In your menu system, with the Canon, you're going to have, it'll be a picture style, or it'll say, it'll allow you to pick what you want. JPEG only, RAW only, or JPEG plus RAW. I use the JPEG plus RAW for all my images. I save both a RAW and a JPEG processed in the camera. And that way I've got the RAW if I want it, or I may be pretty well satisfied with the camera's development, JPEG. But that way you're backed up. Now, the disadvantage is that the RAW images are much bigger. Your JPEG in that ADD is probably going to be about 8 or 9 megabytes. Your RAW might be 30 megabytes. So you got to have some larger cards that probably has an SD card in it. You're going to have some of the like 128s or at least a 64 gigabyte card.
And Charles, once you get back to your computer and you download the RAW, I like to think of in terms of it's the image on 10 different kinds of film. And you can then say, oh, I had this set for outdoor film and I shot it inside. Well, you can change it right there because it's nothing but a series of ones and zeros. It's just a digital format that, like Dr. Mills had said, everything is there. So there is a little learning curve on how you, quote, process the RAW. You can't see a RAW image because it's just electronic data. The computer is going to give you some kind of JPEG-type image, but you can say, whoa. I want to change this to have a different light source, and you can do that. But think of it in terms of your old Minolta. I just shot 10 different slides of film, and I got to decide later which type film I want it to be processed as.
And you can also, I would recommend, go to iTunes and search your camera ADD, Canon ADD, and you're going to find a lot of iTunes, a lot of videos on the menu system of the ADD or an introduction and how to use the camera. I found that it's a valuable source of information as you're getting started using that camera, just on readily available free on iTunes.
And that's one of the great things that I think Dr. Mills has brought up. We all like to talk about what we're doing in iTunes and YouTube and all the rest. Right. You can find many people that will give you ideas on how to improve what you're doing.
Oh, YouTube is great. You should search on YouTube. I said iTunes. I meant YouTube.
Right. Okay. But I mean,
you're right.
You put into Google that particular camera and use of RAW, and we'll talk to you in 6 months.
Yeah.
Because they will cover you up with information. But welcome back into the fold.
I got really good with my old Minolta. I used to go develop my film out here at LSUS in the lab, and used to do the little 10 seconds here or a couple seconds here and move my card over to figure out what exposure I wanted and all that. So this is all new to me.
Well, if you stop and go back to the basics, put it on manual, it's f-stops, it's shutter speeds, and it's focus. And it's just like shooting your old film. Then you get in. There are also many, many digital training programs that you can either sign up. I mean, LSUS teaches some.
Yeah.
I mean, you can learn on that, but it's it may look to be a daunting task, but the opportunities there to let that creativity loose are just fabulous.
And Photoshop Elements is a relatively inexpensive program, the toned-down Photoshop. And likewise on YouTube and other sources, you can get a lot of good reviews on how to use it. And it'll do just about everything you need to do with image development.
Okay. Dr. Mills, one of the questions I always ask people, my guest is, and this would be perfect for Charles as he comes back into it, what advice would you give? If you just had to sit down with somebody that says, I got a camera, I want to start taking pictures, technical vision, what advice would you give them?
Get out there and take some pictures. You know, that's the first step to do. You're not going to get any better if you don't get out and practice. It's like anything we do, it's practice, practice, practice. But the neat thing about photography is you can go to some great places to practice. And if you're not sure how to use that new digital camera, just put it on the green thing on the dial, which is automatic. Most of these cameras are so smart, they'll take the right exposures for you. And then you can learn about how to use all the other parts of the dial. Put it on the green, which is automatic, and get out there and shoot and come back and look at them on the computer.
So if you've set the camera to program, then all you have to really worry about is your composition and what's in the picture.
Right. Then you just start about the composition and let the camera figure the rest out. As you get better, then you can change these aperture and time settings once you learn what they are.
I've found that one of the things that has pushed me in the photography in the use of my camera is when I see an image and I know what I want to get and I don't know how to make the camera do it.
Right.
So as soon as you need, I know that Nikon will do it. I just have to go back and learn. And it's, you miss a goal or two, you learn to kick straighter. Right.
The websites out there are fantastic now that you can go to and really learn everything you need to know on the web.
You had mentioned Flickr earlier as a sharing site, and I'm new to it. It's really a teaching site as well, apparently.
Right, and people, you can ask people questions, and they'll comment on your photos. You can ask them how they did things.
So if I'm going through Flickr and see a particular picture that's really intriguing, a backlit fisherman right. in the Polynesia, I can write to that photographer and say, how did you get that reflection off the water?
You can comment right on their photo. And everybody puts their email as well. You can send them an email. But a lot of times right under the photos are comment boxes. So you can comment and make a question. And people are very open and free about discussing their work. They love it.
Well, I will warn the listeners out there that if you start getting into Flickr, it can just consume you with the number of images that are being captured and shared now.
Yeah.
You're looking through millions of people's scrapbooks.
Millions a day are taken. There's an explore function you can do there that's the 100 best photos of the day. Now, I've been fortunate. I've had that 42 times I've made the list. But I never got higher than about number 30. So I'm striving to get an image that goes past number 30 for the day.
And so you've 40 times you've been listed as the 100 best photographs, and that's based off of a worldwide.
How they base it on there, they have complex algorithms. I can't tell you. But, it's wonderful when you get it. It makes you feel really good.
Well, that's probably the best tip of all. Get onto Flickr and start looking at it and go. Kermit's giving me the high sign that we're running down on time, so I need to stop and take just a minute to thank Dr. Mills not only for coming and sharing with us the wisdom, but for bringing his Freeport 40 out of 100, 40 times being the top 100, and that's worldwide. I really recommend GMills31 on Flickr. Go look at the page because the range is absolutely amazing. I also have to thank Kermit, Wally, Renee, Henry, back in the back room. If it takes the village of Flickr to raise a photographer, it takes the village of our staff here to keep these shows going. So I can't tell you how much we appreciate that. Remember, send your favorite photograph of your balloon shots to ross@thebetterpicture.org and get ready for our hot air roundup. And as always, get close, stay focused, and keep shooting.